and we will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2468 and House Bill 2458. And we will welcome Representatives Jensen and Crump. Good morning, gentlemen.
Jim. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Representative, why don't you start?
I am Bob Jensen, State Representative from House District 58, which includes the towns or cities of Hermiston and Pendleton and various and sundry other smaller communities located there in that general area. My district is pretty specifically confined to Umatilla County as such. The two bills before you that we are interested in bringing to this committee for consideration. The first bill that I'd like to speak to is House Bill 2458. And for those of you who are familiar with the history of the Endangered Species Act,
58 or 58?
Is that okay, appropriate? I'm sorry. 2458?
Yes,
that's fine. For those of you who are familiar with the State Endangered Species Act, you will recall that at its passage, statutorily, the legislature listed those species that had been listed by the Federal Endangered Species Act at the time, and it is specifically only those species that were statutorily listed that the intent of the drafters of the bill, that this bill addressed. Specifically, what the intent of the bill is that if a species was grandfathered in as an endangered species under Oregon Endangered Species Law, simply because it was initially listed by the federal government under the Federal Endangered Species Act, then if the federal government delists that species, if the federal government delists that species, that it also then be delisted by the state. Now, in the latter sentence on section 2 that you have in front of you there, you will note that the commission may add by rule to the list, et cetera, pursuant, et cetera, those species that are removed pursuant to this subsection when the commission follows the listing procedures described in 4-6 of this section. And that is when they do the review of the species and determine that it is threatened or endangered. And that's, really simply the only intent of this bill was to address those species that were, again, statutorily listed by being grandfathered in because the feds had listed them when our initial Endangered Species Act was enacted. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or ask my colleague if he has any comments. Sir. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17.
Yes, sir.
And I really only want to add one thing here, and it makes, I think, the ultimate common sense statement that if the federal government were to choose to delist a species, that means that that species has achieved a level of recovery that the federal government has deemed necessary or appropriate to remove from the list of endangered species. And it seems to me that if the federal government, which I believe has a much higher standard of recovery, finds it wise to do so, then we in the state should follow suit also. Keeping in mind that the federal government will be looking at a species' entire range for recovery issues, and in Oregon we look typically at a very narrow range of recovery. And I believe that Representative Jensen and I have a following bill in that will come to your committee sometime later that has a perhaps a modification under Oregon's Endangered Species Act that would fall more in line with the federal Endangered Species Act. So again, the logic of this bill is pretty simple. If the federal government believes that a species has been recovered, then we in Oregon ought to follow suit, recognize that, and pull our listing at the same time.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of in regards to HB 2458?
May I ask questions?
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good to see you both. Can you tell us how many species are still listed here in Oregon by virtue of this provision that have been removed by the feds?
Representative Rosenbaum. I can't speak with any authority on that. I think the Department of Fish and Wildlife will be present, or are present to testify, and they may be able to speak to that. I do think there's one that they mentioned, and I don't know whether it meets exactly the qualifications you're talking about, but the Aleutian goose, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, yeah. I'll wait to hear from them. Thanks.
Yes. Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for appearing today. I'm a rookie, so it helps to get a little guidance on these issues. I think a common sense approach is logical, and I think probably the three of us would agree that the federal government doesn't always act in ultimate wisdom. We might not agree exactly on the issues that that we think they're not acting on. As I read the lines 12 through 14 on page 1 of 2458, this says that the state may not, it means that under no circumstances can the state have an animal on its Endangered Species Act that the federal government has removed from its act. And do I really understand the intent of this to say that we can't bring Oregon logic to this and other issues once the federal government has acted on issues? I mean, we can't say there's some reason why Oregon would be interested in maintaining something on this list, even though the federal government made a stupid decision, or even though they made a wise decision.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, I understand you know what you're saying, but I do think you need to read the paragraph and note the line that I mentioned a moment ago, that the commission may add by to the list, you know, by simply following the procedures and processes that it would for normal listing.
Which
and
you could do now. I'm sorry, sir.
I was going to finish this with the intent of this bill. Is addressing a category of listed species that process was not followed in the state of Oregon, that were statutorily listed. You read in, you know, the 1A that it says, except as provided, and then this is obviously in the new language in Section 2, those species of wildlife listed as of May 15th, 1987, as a threatened species or endangered species pursuant to the Federal Endangered Species Act, are part of the listed group, and that is the category that we are addressing. The state has not even gone through its logical, if you wish, or common sense, or process, and hopefully the process that we in the legislature outline for them is a common sense process. Maybe not always, but hopefully.
Does Fish and Wildlife have the delisting authority now to do that under the rules we've set for them? I mean, could they do this without this bill?
I think there is some question in some cases as to whether they may. I'll let them speak to that. Mr. Chair, in all due respect to this bill, and I believe Brendan McCarthy is here, and if it would be with your permission to have maybe Brendan come up, but I think there may be an amendment we need to in fact do that, to what we're talking about. So,
Mr. McCarthy, present.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chair, while Brendan's coming, I might add to Representative Greenlick, the point I think you were driving at also was, should Oregon in some circumstances have the ability to apply our own Endangered Species Act or perhaps solutions? And that really addresses the issue that will be talked about in House Bill 2468, which is the next bill, and we'll be chatting about that, and so we'll have that discussion there also.
Good morning, Chair Girard, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy from Legislative Council. The question is whether species that are listed pursuant to 496-176-1A, which are those species that were put on the list automatically when the list was created because their status under the federal law could be removed under current law by the commission, and I believe the answer is no. Under current law, they are bound. The language of 496-176 says that the state list shall include A, those species that were listed in 1987 on the federal list, and B, those species that were listed on the state list that the commission determined as of 1987 belonged on the state list as well. So those two things are required. And if, as could come to pass, a species was removed from a federal list, endangered or threatened status, I believe that our state law would require, if that species was listed prior to 1987, for that to remain on the state list. So, for example, I believe that the gray whale was removed from the federal list. If the gray whale was put on the federal list before 1987, I believe it was, and has appeared on the state list, which I believe that it does as well, that gray whale could not be removed from the state list, even though it has been downgraded according to the federal government.
Thank you. Your question answered.
Thank you.
Any other questions in regarding 2458? Okay. Representative Krupp, are you going to do 2468?
I would be more than happy to, Mr. Chair. And if we'll ask Brendan to stay here, and since he's here. Mr. Chair, for the record again, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17. And House Bill 2468 is very simple in its concept. It simply prohibits the State Wildlife Commission from listing a threatened and endangered species that are listed under federal law. Now, this was an original concept that Representative Jensen and I had chatted about previously. We decided to put it into legislative form. We have since had discussions with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they will be following us. They would like to have some, they would like to retain some flexibility in that regard, because, and they make, I think, a fair argument that the state should have the opportunity to list a species under the Oregon Endangered Species Act before the federal listing, and this has actually occurred in some cases, in the hopes that the state of Oregon could put in place policies for recovery that would, in fact, be our own Oregon solution and flexibility that would be acceptable to the federal government and, in essence, hold off a listing on the federal government side. And, you know, Oregon is famous for trying to be innovative and a leader in many areas, and I think back to the Oregon plan as one of those areas where we try to come up with our own solutions to some of the federal government mandates. And I think that's a fair argument that ODFNW brings forward, that they should retain some flexibility. So we're willing to sit down and chat with them here to see if we can find a methodology within the basic concept of legislation to achieve that.
Very good. Any questions of Representative Crowe?
Chair, if I might add, Representative Bob Denson, again, House District 58. I think, you know, this issue of Oregon taking the lead or active role is extremely well illustrated in the Oregon plan, basically the Oregon plan for the recovery of salmon. The intent of that plan was to prevent a federal listing, which it might well have done had it not been for a judge who decided that voluntary aspects of it were insufficient, in his opinion, to achieve the goal. However, even though the judge, even though the judge ruled that way, subsequently, I think we've seen the National Marine Fisheries Service and the federal agencies give a lot of respect to the Oregon plan. And again, I'm back on salmon, but to the Oregon plan and having us carry a lead role in that, which I believe is what the department is trying to protect and preserve in their concerns with this.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add one last two points of consideration, is part of the purpose of this legislation is to prevent what we think is duplicative listings. If the federal government lists a species that would apply to Oregon, then it, in my mind, doesn't make a great deal of, again, common sense for us to follow on with an additional listing. Now, why is that important? Well, this is the second point, is that keep in mind Oregon's Endangered Species Act, by statute, applies to state-owned lands only. Sort of. Now, let me say sort of, because if you'll think back to the last session, 2001, we had a controversy erupting over on the east side, very near Representative Jensen's district, where squirrels versus windmills issue came about, where we had the Washington ground squirrel, which is listed under the Oregon Endangered Species Act and not under the federal ESA, and by the way, is not listed in Washington either, on either one. But in Oregon, it stopped for a time and caused a modification of a wind power project up on the Columbia Gorge. And this wind power project, keep in mind, was on private land. So the statute should not have applied, in my thinking. However, by administrative rule, there is an administrative rule that in essence says, and Brendan and I sometimes disagree on this issue, but it says that state agencies have to comply with provisions of the Oregon Endangered Species Act, and I'm paraphrasing. So in essence, the Department of Energy the Oregon Department of Energy had to conduct a review of this wind power project and ultimately discovered that there were Washington ground squirrels there. So that caused some red flags to go up, and ultimately the project was delayed for a time and was actually downsized, even though the Oregon Endangered Species Act, by statute, cannot apply to private lands. By administrative rule, it was. Now, that is a following piece of legislation that Representative Jensen and I will most likely be bringing forward to this committee. We passed that in the last session. Governor Kitzhaber vetoed that, even after we made a number of compromises to it to try to satisfy the governor's office. We're hopeful that Governor Kulongoski's staff will be more receptive to what we again think are common sense revisions to the Oregon Endangered Species Act to clarify that it can only apply to state-owned lands and by administrative rule cannot be applied to private lands. Now, why does that matter in the context of this bill? Well, that sort of is one of the reasons why we brought this bill forward, was to again further clarify there is a difference between the Federal Endangered Species Act and the Oregon Endangered Species Act, and that why should we duplicate the two of them? So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Representative Krupp or Jensen? Seeing none, gentlemen, we thank you very much for your time. We know
it's
valuable.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Committee, we have seven people who have wished to testify on 2458, so we'll take 2458 first. Glenn Stonebring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I represent the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and on this issue, I also represent the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. My comments, so that, do you want me to just to stick on this bill, or do you want me to do both bills at the same time?
You can do both bills at the same time. Please differentiate when you switch from one to the other.
2458 is, to me, a very simple bill, and we support it. It makes a lot of sense, as already been mentioned, that if the feds delist a species, then Oregon should delist the same species. If for no other reason, it reduces the duplication, and when we have duplication, it costs the state money. In 1995, Representative Burl Tarno from Coos County introduced legislation into the Endangered Species Act to attempt to stop that from happening so that we don't have duplicative listings based upon the cost, but it really hasn't changed anything. As to 2468, that is the essence of that bill, is the removing the grandfather clause, which I have no idea why it was ever put in there. Because it automatically required duplication, that whenever the federal government lists a species, then Oregon must list and protect that species as well. And I want to give you an example of why that doesn't make much sense. And I'm going to use the gray wolf, and I'm not going to preach the whole case of the gray wolf, other than the gray wolf has been extinct in Oregon for over 50 years, and that's from testimony from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife during the last year. So you have a species that is extinct, but because of the grandfather clause and the federal government has the gray wolf listed, then it has to be listed in Oregon even though it's extinct. Now, that doesn't even make sense on the purpose of our Endangered Species Act, because our Endangered Species Act is to protect and recover those species that are threatened or endangered of becoming extinct. and we've had a lot of discussions with the Oregon Department of with the Fish and Wildlife Commission on this subject, and they even agree with that themselves. So what are we required? Now, we all know that in 1995 that the federal government brought wolves from Canada, introduced them into Idaho in an experimental population project, and the first wolf that came across to Oregon with a collar, and they knew it was in Oregon, and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's policy was to ask for it to be removed, take it back to its experimental population boundaries, which the federal government did. But aha, there's a problem, and the Attorney General has ruled that if it's protected under Oregon's Endangered Species Act, which it is, and I just pointed out to you why it was, we really don't have the power to say, take it back. We shouldn't even be saying, take it back, because we have a law that's trying to protect it. Secondly, if we have a species listed, and this is any species, but I'm using the wolf as the example, when we have it here, then we're not just to sit idly by and see if it recovers on its own. We're supposed to put together a recovery plan. Well, now remember, we, other than those that were brought in from Canada to Idaho, the wolf is extinct, and we're to put together a recovery plan to recover an extinct species. Now, I don't know what the cost will be, but there's been estimates anywhere from $200,000 to $2 million. To me, it just makes sense, and especially in the economic crisis that we have today, we don't spend that kind of money on something that's duplicative, and in this case of the wolf that I gave you, is rather a ridiculous situation. I'd be happy to answer any question.
Any questions for Mr. Stoneberg? Seeing none, thank you, Clint.
Thank you.
Roy Elliker and Ron Appen. Ron, I massacred that. Very embarrassing for a radio guy to mess up.
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Mr. Ron Anglin, he is the Wildlife Division Administrator for the Department, and on his right, Mr. Martin Nugent, who is the Program Leader of the Wildlife Diversity Program, and that is the program responsible for the State Endangered Species Act and how it's implemented by the Department. And as some of you may know, the Act has probably come under scrutiny more than any other piece of wildlife legislation in the last few sessions. And we do have some prepared testimony ourselves that we'd like to give, and then we are prepared to answer what might be quite a lot of questions about the Act, which is why Mr. Nugent here in particular and Mr. Anglin. Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I guess we should probably start with 2458.
Be fine.
I'll take a look, kind of go from our prepared comments on that. 2458 directs the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to remove species from the state list of threatened endangered species when species are removed from the Federal Endangered Species Act. That's the federal list. As you know, the state act was created to prevent the extinction of native fish and wildlife species in Oregon. It focuses its actions on state-owned and state-leased land, or land in which the state has recorded easement, and is a means by which state lands can contribute to the recovery of listed species. In addition, and let me emphasize this, the state act is very beneficial to establish partnerships with the federal government to recover listed species, and is an important vehicle identifying risk to species and promoting recovery efforts. We're concerned about the language in House Bill 2458, Section 2. I know Mr. McCarthy came up to clarify it. For the record, however, these comments are based on how the bill is written now. From talking to the bill sponsors, they wanted to merely have a clause that would remove those federal species that were grandfathered on the federal list as of May of 1987. And from looking at the bill's language as it's currently in front of you, I wasn't sure that it did that. So that was a concern that we can work out legislative counsel. In the estimation of our attorneys, the Department of Justice, as the bill is written right now, we didn't feel like it would clearly distinguish between the species listed by commission's actions since 1987 and those that are, quote, grandfathered onto list as of the creation of the Oregon Act in 1987. We're also concerned that though the bill would then, of the species grandfathered, that it would direct us to remove some species from the list, frankly, the way the state act is written now, we have some of our own problems with the act in that it does not provide enough flexibility for us to delist some species that have been removed from the federal list. And I guess one of our best examples is that the Aleutian Canada goose, a small dark goose that nests in the Aleutians and winters off the Oregon coast or right on the Oregon coast, about down mid-coast, a few months a year. Back in the 50s or so, it was in very small numbers. It was due to fox predation, foxes being introduced in some of the islands on the Aleutians where the goose nested. It was one of the earliest waterfowl species ever put on endangered species list. The service did a lot of work on the Aleutian Islands to protect its habitat and essentially kill all the foxes that were feeding on the goose. They actually at one point raised Aleutian Canada geese up on the Aleutians, I'm told. Anyway, they have essentially recovered in numbers and have been removed from the federal list here just within the last 2 years. Unfortunately, the way the Oregon law is currently written, it doesn't allow us to remove the goose from our list because the fact that its life history primarily occurs outside the state. And that's kind of a segue into what I call Attachment A, which is our department's own review in the last several months of some potential improvements to the act that we would like to see as a state, as a state agency. We think that would help to clarify the act, clarify its intent, give it the flexibility needed to provide recovery vehicle as needed, and flexibility to remove species that for some reason or other, like Aleutian Canada goose, were having problems with their own law, an animal that should be off the list. We can't legally remove it according to our attorneys at the Department of Justice. That ends my prepared comments, Mr. Chair, on 2458. I would like, if you would like, I'm not sure your time, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Anglin. If you, the Chair would like, we can go through this Attachment A in a little more clarity. I guess I'll sum up my general march in saying, I know these are the first two bills. There's going to be a number of bills come to this committee on the State Endangered Species Act. I guess it might be the request of the department, or it would be the request of the department, that perhaps a work group to work on a number of these bills take forward the issues as identified here today and with the other bills and also with the issues identified by the governor's office and ODFW that we would like to see changed in the act, maybe come up with a comprehensive set of amendments to address the entire issue. But if the chair would like, we could in more detail go over Attachment A or move on to the next bill.
Let's look at Attachment A.
Okay.
Chair Garrard, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Staff sat down and took a comprehensive look at the act and tried to come up with what we felt were the things that proved to be stumbling blocks for us in using the act to do the things that it was initially directed to do. And I think it was fairly clear right off the bat that the act does not really give a clear definition or a clear statement of the need of the Oregon Endangered Species Act and what it is all about and what its purpose is for. So we felt that it would be real important if we had the ability to go through with any amendments to come up with what is the overarching purpose of this act. And as part of that, the act is currently not define what recovery is, and we feel that if we're going to work towards recovery on state lands, that we need to define within statute what that is so that everybody has a clear idea of the exact nature of what we're working towards. And wrapped into that, the recovery portion of it is that we feel that the Act right now is fairly weak in allowing us to work with our partners to develop conservation plans that will ensure that we do reach recovery of the species. You can see from the solutions section there under this number three that we have offered several different suggestions that we feel would help us in reaching the goals of the Act and removing species from the list. As mentioned by Deputy Director Elliker, we currently have a problem delisting some species. And we've tried and run into some what turn out to be stumbling blocks within the Act that actually prevent us from moving ahead. And we feel that it's very appropriate to remove species from the Act and would like to be able to do so. Number five, one of the problems that we do have is once a need is established for a listing of a species, it can take up to a month for that to occur, and perhaps longer if there's an emergency need. And that has to do with the way things are filed through the Secretary of State's office and finally published in the Secretary of State bulletin. And we would like to have the ability to refine the Act so that if there's truly an emergency, that we can make that effective immediately so that we can start working to prevent the slip of the species. And wrapped into that is, as we move through a process to list a species, that we feel it would be very important that right off the bat, that as part of that listing process, that there be some detailed survival guidelines laid out that would serve as an interim until a conservation plan can actually be developed to lead to long-term recovery. And currently we do not have that ability, and by putting that into the statute, it can clearly define that in the short term what are the steps that we need to take and how to get there until we can get into the actual conservation and recovery plan. And the current Act also lists individual species, and we feel that that should probably be species as a whole, so that we're not talking about an individual bald eagle as an example, but we're talking about bald eagles across the state on state lands, and that we feel that would be a whole awful lot more appropriate to deal with the populations instead of individuals. And then finally, that the implementation of the TAKE provisions within the state ESA is listed number 8. Are not clear in direct take versus indirect take. We have the ability, or the Commission has the ability, to define how indirect take can occur. However, there are some direct take activities that also do occur. When
Ron, would you define what take, the definition of take for the committee, please?
Take under state law, Chair Girard, is defined as to bring into possession or control of. It is different than the federal term, which is harass, molest, worry, disturb, etc. Ours is mainly just to bring into possession, kill, or capture. So we're operating under a different definition than what the federal statute operates under, and we're not proposing any changes to that at this point in time.
Thank you.
The direct take aspect of it is would come into play for us and for other agencies that are collecting scientific information, and at times you do have to take possession of that animal, whether you do need to kill it in order to do some work, or just the physical act of capturing it and holding it for a period of time, you know, like for fish, taking scale samples, measurements, etc., and then turning it loose. Under our state statute currently, it is very difficult for us to get there with the permit system that we have, and we feel it would be very beneficial to have that allowed within the statute. So those, just real broad and general, were some things that we came up with that we felt were some ways that could be used to strengthen the Act and get it to work for the state of Oregon in a way that I think the original authors intended.
Any questions of Mr. Anklin? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had asked earlier how many species we still had on our listing, although they've been removed from the federal. Do you have that information? Or?
Yes, we do. With your permission, Chair Gard, I'll have Martin Nugent answer that.
Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, sir. My name is Martin Nugent. I'm Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm Wildlife Diversity Program Manager. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, there are currently on the state lists, just to broaden it a little bit, there are 36 listings of species there, and on that list, five species that were on the federal list the federal government has removed in recent years. In the total list, 27 were grandfathered onto the list, the mechanism that was described a little earlier on, and the 9 listings were put onto the state list through commission action.
Thank you.
Mr. Nugent, have we ever has Oregon ever delisted?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have. In 1994, the Columbian white-tailed deer was removed from the state list, and that was a species that met the delisting criteria under the state statute, and preceded by a long way the federal action, which still hasn't actually happened yet for that particular species.
So in that particular situation, Oregon was in front of...
Indeed, yes, sir.
Could I follow up?
Representative Greenlee.
Could I ask which are those 5 that are still on and to what extent you think they ought to be on as opposed to ought to be off?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, the species that have been removed by the federal government that are still on the state list, the Aleutian Canada goose that Deputy Director Ellicker indicated earlier on, there's the American peregrine falcon, and the Arctic peregrine falcon, the grey wolf is in that process, and the grey whale is another species that's been removed already by the Fish and Wildlife mm-hmm. Service.
I don't know how you follow that, sir.
Well,
and do you think our delisting process would remove all 5 of those if you had the authority to do that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, apart from the issue that was described a little earlier on, the delisting process is there in statute now and relies on walking through scientific criteria that have to be met for that particular species, and providing the scientific case is there and that the other conditions are also met too, then delisting can proceed through the normal rulemaking that the Fish and Wildlife Commission would undertake. So there are some constraints, but there are mechanisms built in already.
Just one thought. Even with the ones that are grandfathered?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, yes, there is no distinction in the current statute that makes any difference between grandfathered species and other species in terms of removing from the list. It's the same process.
That's contrary to what?
Yeah, that's not what the LC said.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that's correct. We do not agree with Legislative Council's interpretation there, but we could get our council and talk to their council, and we come back with a more definitive answer. It's our sense from our extensive work on the Act that there's no difference on delisting issues, whether it was grandfathered in or put on by the Commission. We have a problem with delisting on species that, because their life history, are only here for a few months, like Aleutian Canada goose. But the issue of grandfathering, and we have not been told by our council, is an issue on the removal side.
Okay. Thank you, and I hope you will get back to the committee in that regard. We'll conclude the testimony on 2458, and I don't know, do you want to go to 2468? Or
I could do that, sir, if you'd like, whatever me would like. Okay, while we're here. Again, for the record, Roy Ellicker, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, with Mr. Anglin, our Wildlife Administrator, and Mr. Martin Nugent, our Program Leader, Wildlife Diversity. Some of the initial comments on 2468, sir, are essentially the same as 2458, and essentially, again, discusses the state act, what its role is. However, I went on this bill, which would prohibit the State Fish and Wildlife Commission from listing species under the Oregon Act. If they're already listed under the federal act, we did want to point out as department that the current act already gives us that flexibility under law now, that the commission can decide not to list a species if it's already listed under the federal act. We also have an example right now of an animal we're considering listing now in the department, but we have not really taken it to the commission yet, and that is, if you look at my third paragraph describing the Modoc sucker, which is a sucker-like fish, primarily in California. And here the point is...
You have to be careful talking about sucker fish around me. I'm just a little sensitive in
that area. I understand, Representative Garrard, but let me use an example, and hopefully it won't inflame any passion. The Modoc sucker is currently listed by the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service in California. It was listed in 1985. At the time, Oregon was not included in that listing because it was not found in Oregon. It was believed not to be native to Oregon. So we were not included in the species range when it got listed by the federal side. It has been since found in the Goose Lake Basin, adjacent to the California border. And so the feds right now are considering expanding its federally endangered range to include Oregon. Now, one of the things we are considering is we're working with the Fish and Wildlife Service now, seeing if we can't, if we added it to our state list and we took a role or lead in recovery in the state of Oregon, could we not have it added to the federal list under the Oregon range? In other words, we want the flexibility at times, as Representative Krupp said, to look for our own solutions. And again, that's what the Oregon Plan is all about. And this flexibility sometimes of it may be on the overall federal list, but by if we put it on the state list, we take the lead in recovery. I think that's a lot more, that's a lot easier for other Oregonians to understand that the state will take the lead on a state-listed species rather than have the feds come in and lay the heavy hand of the federal jurisdiction on top of our citizens. And so I guess my point is on 2468 is we already have the flexibility to not list species if they're already in the federal list, but we do have the flexibility to list them as well, and I think in the end the department would prefer that we keep that flexibility rather than eliminate it.
Any questions? I guess I got one. Why would you list a species under the Oregon ESA if it were already on the federal ESA? What would be the purpose of doing that?
The purpose would be that between the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service and the Federal Wildlife Services, which includes NOAA Fisheries, Fish and Wildlife Service, and there might be some others in there, but those are the two main ones, these federal agencies don't operate in a vacuum. And there are times when we have listed species, and the fact that we have listed them and taken the lead in recovery meant that the feds have not acted when they have been petitioned for a species to put on the federal list. The fact that we already have it on the state list and are taking efforts right now in recovery, the feds have communicated to us, well, there's no need to list right now. The state is taking action to lead to recovery. And that is that's the main reason we think that why the state list is very helpful to the state.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Anklin, did you have any comments? Mr. News? Any questions of our guests? Representative Zone.
You talk about putting them on the list, Oregon taking the lead. How about Oregon taking the lead and taking some off the list? How do you feel about that if you find one?
I feel very good about that. If we have species that we feel meet the scientific and legal criteria, they're removed from the list. But in other words, one of the reasons we found the problems we did with the delisting process, Representative Zahner, is when the feds moved to delist Aleutian Canada geese, we immediately thought, well, good, let's get this off our list too. And that's when we ran into problems with its life history, and the legal counsel said the way our act was currently written, we could not remove it. But the department feels strongly that animals that are on the road to recovery or have recovered, there's no need to keep them on the list. That's not the function of the list, just to list animals on there. We're better off to show an active listing and delisting of animals as we recover them. I think that's beneficial to everybody.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions, gentlemen, thank you.
Sure.
Warren, Amy? Amy?
Ames?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafuri. I'm here with Warren E. on the legislative liaison for the Wildlife Society. I'd like briefly, before we talk our testimony, to talk a little bit about the Wildlife Society. We are not an advocacy organization such as the Sierra Club or the Wilderness Society. Our organization is a scientific society of wildlife biologists. Our main purpose is to educate ourselves and our and the public about the scientific issues in wildlife biology. We have regular seminars where people present papers the same as any other kind of scientific society. We basically come to this legislature not in terms of advocacy or favoring or opposing specific pieces of legislation, but we do think we have expertise in two areas, one in the science of wildlife biology and second in the area of wildlife management. Our members come from various employment backgrounds. Not only are we employees of state and federal agencies, but independent contractors. These days, if people who are landowners want to do anything to their land, they need to hire biologists often. We fill that function. We work for power companies. We work for public utilities. We have a very wide employment range so that when we come together and make decisions about positions, we're not representing one narrow viewpoint, but we think as much as possible the viewpoint of the scientific wildlife biology community. That being said, I want to make one point very clear, which I think has not been made clear. It took a long time last session, I think, to get this point, but I think legislators understood it, and I see a lot of new faces here today, so I want to repeat it. There's an enormous distinction between listing and implementation of that listing. The listing process should be a scientific process. The issue of whether a species is in danger or not is not a political question. It's a scientific question. It should be decided by scientific bodies or agencies working with scientific bodies. The legislature is not a good place to decide whether a species is in danger or not. Implementation, once you've found out that a species is listed because it's endangered, that is a political process. At that point, political considerations come in. And the Threatened Endangered Species Act, both at the state and the federal level, makes that clear distinction. When you decide whether to list or not, you don't look at the economic implications. You look at the science. When you look at the implementation of that, what are the effects of that decision going to be? That's the point you look at: economic considerations, social considerations, and both the state and federal law have that distinction so that you can take a look at other issues when you're deciding what you're going to do about that listing. But you shouldn't take a look at those issues when you're deciding whether to or not to list. I'd like to introduce Mr. Aney.
Representative Gerard, members of the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning. You got my name right the first time.
Good.
My name is Warren Aney, as you've heard. I'm a professionally certified senior wildlife ecologist with over 40 years' experience in my field. As Stephen mentioned, I am here as the Conservation Affairs Chair for the Oregon Chapter of the Wildlife Society, which is a professional society of about 600 members in the state of Oregon. Starting with House Bill 2458, as we understand it, the proposed legislation would require the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to remove from the state list of threatened and endangered species any species that is removed from listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act, regardless of the status of that species within Oregon. It does allow relisting of the species if the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission goes through the procedures established for determining that species status and vulnerability. Oregon has a clearly defined wildlife policy in ORS 496.012 that pertains to threatened and endangered species. It begins with this statement of comment, a commitment for all wildlife of Oregon. It is the policy of the state of Oregon that wildlife shall be managed to prevent the serious depletion of any indigenous species. The proposed legislation, in our view, would have the effect of letting a federal decision decide the status of a species indigenous to Oregon until such a time as Oregon determines otherwise. A species that may be in healthy condition in other parts of its range may be still in a depleted condition in Oregon. If a federal agency delists this species, Oregon then is required under this proposed legislation to also delist this species until authorities go through the process of relisting the species, a process that could take months or, in some cases, if it's a controversial issue, maybe even years. ORS 496.176 already contains provisions for delisting a species, regardless of whether or not it qualifies for federal listing, in our view. As ODFW has pointed out to you, this provision can be made adequate to meet the presumed objectives of this legislation. And I think your objectives are to delist a species at the state level after it has been removed from the federal list if there is scientifically credible evidence that there's no longer any need to retain the species on this list, and we endorse that process. So we see no scientific reason to change Oregon's scientifically based and effective protection of at-risk species at this time, except for some of the modifications that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is looking into. Are there any questions about House Bill 2458 and our position on that bill?
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Aney, I have questions that kind of goes to the basis of these bills, and that is, what is meant by scientifically credible evidence? For instance, if you were going to decide to list a species, what is the process that gives you the scientific basis for that listing decision to be made?
Chairman Girard, Representative Richardson, easy answer is the legislature is going to define what science is. There's a bill to that effect, I believe. but beyond that, scientifically credible is that information which has been researched and developed through scientific information collection processes, testing of hypotheses, using tests of hypotheses and peer reviews to say that this is the kind of information that is reproducible. In other words, if somebody else went out and did the same type of information collection, they would probably come up, they have a high likelihood of coming up with the same results. It's information that is predictable. In other words, if you make a decision based on that information, you have a high reliability of seeing results based on that prediction. So it's information can be used to making reliable decisions that have foreseeable, highly predictable outcomes.
Can you follow? All right, so is it correct for us to bank on that if before Oregon would add another species to the endangered species list, that it would be subject to peer review and the decision would be based on, you know, science that is reproducible?
The current process in Oregon emphasizes scientifically credible information. Yes.
Of course, I'm dealing with the definition of what it means to be scientifically credible, and so would the decision be subject to peer review and indications that it would be reproducible? I mean, it's not just one person making a decision that they think this, but that it would, it's best science, essentially.
Chairman Girard, Representative Richardson, in the cases that I have been familiar with, this has been the case, yes.
Okay. Is your society involved in the evaluation of a species before it would be added to the Oregon endangered species list?
Yes, we have in the past, and we'll be available to do that in the future.
Okay. May I follow?
Follow.
And now switching our attention to the delisting process, would you explain what would be the process in determining whether or not a species has recovered sufficiently that it could be delisted?
The process, as I understand it, and I'm referring to the legislation now, or the statutes right now, is that the commission determines that the species is secure outside the state or the species is not. There's a couple of provisions, and I only found one of them. Mm-hmm. It's a little hard sometimes to pull these things.
Well, I understand.
Basically, it's the same process, using scientifically credible information based on the species status, getting information about its population, its vulnerability, the condition of its habitat, and that it's in a reproducing state or increasing or stable state within the state. Yes, that's it is based on scientific the established principles for collecting and interpreting that information.
Okay. Follow again?
Follow.
Mr. Kafouri was kind of explained to us that there are certain things that the scientific community should be involved in and certain things the legislature should be involved in, and that listing would be scientific and then sure. The process certainly could be legislative. And I'm thinking that that probably would apply to delisting, and so to refer to the statute that we write as to a process for delisting, you know, kind of puts on our burden, on us the burden that really is scientific. And so what I'm trying to determine is actually what happens. I mean, how is this delisting? They delisted the white-tailed deer. Do you have any idea what goes into that and how frequently the scientific community may be looking at those species that are on the list to determine whether or not sufficient recovery has occurred that they should be delisted? And the reason I'm getting to all this is that this bill didn't just, you know, wasn't just somebody's brainchild. There's a lot of concern over whether or not Oregon's process of this may, in these issues, may be overly restrictive or somewhat arbitrary, so there's a feeling among some that maybe it ought to be connected to the federal program rather than duplicating our efforts, because there may be some concern that scientific procedures may not be utilized.
Chairman Gillard, Representative Richardson, what I'm going to give you is my interpretation of how it works, and I have worked with a number of issues on listing and delisting, or not delisting, but on listing state species. And if I turn out to be wrong, allow me to send you a correction. There's basically three elements: the original listing, which should be scientifically based; the recovery, developing a recovery plan, which can bring into it then at that time the economic and social issues as well as the scientific issues, and deciding where and how to best go about recovering the species. And then the third, which is a delisting process, once this recovery plan has succeeded, the determination again to delist the species is primarily a scientific decision based on what has happened to that species in terms of population status, habitat condition, and whether or not it is in an end distribution as to whether or not it's in a healthy condition. So, yes, in my interpretation of it, the delisting is, again, primarily a scientific process.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Annie, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on
good
scientific data, because of the experience in the Klamath Basin, where based on, quote, credible, unquote, scientific data, water was allocated away from the agricultural community, only later to find out that the scientific data was inaccurate. So I have a little problem when you say we're going to use credible scientific data as the only means by which you may list an endangered species, because the credible scientific data apparently is a very subjective statement as to what's credible and what isn't.
Chairman Gerard, first I may... wildlife biologist, and that was primarily a fish issue, but let me venture and get my feet wet on it anyway.
The water's shallow down.
The scientific committee that reviewed the data and came up with the conclusion that you refer to, its conclusion was that there was inadequate scientific information to either increase or decrease the level of water conservation in that area. So they did not support either the action that was proposed or the action that was taken or the contrary action. They said the scientific data was inadequate. It didn't say it was inaccurate. It said it was inadequate.
Who said that?
The federal government asks, and I'd have to get that information for you. It was the scientific community, but I can't remember the exact title of it. Yeah, I'll have to get that information for you. But it's the one you were referring to.
Representative Gerard, if you'd like some detail on that finding, we'd be happy to present that to you individually or to the members of the committee. There's another organization that I used to represent called the American Fisheries Society, which is the fish side of the biologist community. They've chosen not to hire legislative representation this session, so I can't bring them here directly, but I'd be happy to, I'm sure that if I called some folks and said that you're interested in that, we could bring that information to you.
It is not my intent to rehash the problems of the Klamath Basin, but when I hear a statement that listing should be made on credible scientific data, I have to kind of sneeze a little bit, because I don't know what credible scientific data is anymore. And we discovered during that process that scientific data is questionable, depending on its source. So, and that was the only statement I wanted to make in that. So, but I appreciate your offer, Steve.
Representative Garrett, I guess our comment would be, to those folks who look to science as being a hard line answer to all problems, that there's going to be 100% agreement on any issue, you're not going to find those answers. Science is a process, and what you get is the best answer available at the time. Now, that doesn't mean those answers are not going to change as more information comes along. And people are always who want to deride, and I'm not saying you, but there have been critics who want to deride science by saying, well, look, you were wrong 20 years ago. We didn't ever say, if you read carefully in the beginning 20 years ago, that we were right. All we're saying is that at this time, this is the best available evidence we have. And that's what you're going to be always dealing with when you have scientific issues. You're not going to be ever dealing with certainty. I see Representative Greenlook, who's been trained also as a scientist, shaking his head on that. What we have to deal with is the best available science. Now, we have two choices. We can deal with the best available science, or we can not deal with the best available science. We don't have a third alternative. So when you say, well, the best available science is not always perfect, yes, you're absolutely correct. But the alternative of not dealing with the best available science is to deal with politics. And we think that's a less beneficial, less productive way of dealing with issues which ought to be done in the scientific area.
I think we also discovered that there was bias exhibited by those compiling the scientific data. And this is specifically in regard to the Klamath Basin problems. And it was later revealed that there was bias in the scientific data. So again, that's why I bring up the question of the source of the scientific data has to be credible, but who defines what's credible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson asked earlier about the processes and the standards, and part of those standards that help keep science as credible as it can be is a peer review process, so that you have other scientists reviewing the processes by which decisions were made. Again, this is not a perfect process, but it does help ensure that there is scientific credibility that the public can be confident in.
I appreciate the dialogue.
Thank you.
Would you like to move to 2468?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman.
Fine, Mr. Ingram.
Just to answer your previous question, it was the Committee of Scientists of the National Academy of Sciences,
yes,
of Sciences, which did that. And to emphasize what Stephen said, it is a self-correcting process, the scientific process. And if it works right, things do change and adjustments are made, but it has built into it its own review and correction processes. House Bill 2468, as we understand it, the proposed legislation would change Oregon's laws protecting species at risk of serious depletion or extinction in Oregon. It would do this by prohibiting the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission from listing a state threatened or endangered species, any that are covered under the Federal Act as threatened or endangered species, a candidate species, a species for which petitions have been filed for such listing, or a sensitive species. The prohibition would take effect regardless of the actual condition of that species within Oregon. It does not allow those species to be state listed, even if the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission goes through the procedures established by Oregon's legislature for determining that species status or vulnerability. It appears to us that the purpose of this legislation is to remove all federally listed species from the Oregon list, but it's not clear to us that this would be retroactive. I think it was the intent of the authors that this be retroactive, but it's not clear because it may only affect actions taken from the time of the bill's enactment and may not nullify listing decisions made in the past, including decisions by the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to accept federal listings as Oregon listings. Again, referring to Oregon's wildlife policy to prevent the serious depletion of any indigenous species, the proposed legislation would have the effect of letting a federal decision countermand an Oregon decision. This could cripple Oregon's efforts to manage for recovery of a species that is in threat of depletion in the state of Oregon. Because federal management may not always provide for species recovery on a state-by-state basis, in other words, it may be in good condition somewhere else, and they may have recovery plans, or they may have recovery plans for somewhere else. They may not have recovery plans that would be as good as recovery plans that Oregon may develop. So this could, again, result in the serious depletion of an indigenous species in violation of Oregon's wildlife policy. This, of course, would be particularly the case for species listed as federal sensitive, but Oregon threatened or endangered. In other words, a federal classification of sensitive does not require a management recovery program. But Oregon would be prevented from listing that species as threatened or endangered, and so Oregon could not go into an active conservation or recovery program for that species. Some examples: if this legislation is imposed in a retroactive manner, it could remove state protection and weaken recovery management for a number of species, such as the bald eagle, which is federally threatened and Oregon threatened, the brown pelican, which is federally endangered and Oregon endangered, sea otters, which are federally threatened and Oregon threatened, the wolverine, which is federal sensitive and Oregon threatened, or the Washington ground squirrel, which is federal sensitive and Oregon endangered. With regards to the Washington ground squirrel, I understand what Representative Croft was trying to impart to you, and if I could just make a couple of corrections. I think he was correct in the essence of it, but he was talking about Washington ground squirrels versus wind power. It was Washington ground squirrels versus circle irrigation, as I understand, and it was on state-owned land, the former Boeing Park that was put under the state land or State Department of Veterans Affairs, I believe, and eventually ended up being leased for circle irrigation, and there was a proposal to expand that circle irrigation into lands that were determined to be critical habitat for the Washington ground squirrel. There was a study made, and evidence was gathered on the status of that species and its habitat, and there was a subsequent determination by the state of Oregon to list it as a threatened species. It's only a federal sensitive species that's not on the federal threatened or endangered species list. But under this particular legislation, at least as possibly the intent of it, if not the actuality of it, Oregon would not be able to list that species and have a management recovery program for that species because it's listed as a federal sensitive species. So, to make the point that, as we mentioned before, the Department of Fish and Wildlife points out that the present statutes probably could be made adequate to address this issue and maybe meet some of the intents of this, and we see no scientific ranging reason to change this process. Are there any questions?
Any questions, Mr. Ainey? I might also add in your list there that the bald eagle is doing pretty well right now,
right,
and is almost, I think, going to be delisted somewhere.
It was downgraded, or has been, or they, of course, it's always been a threatened species, which is the, you know, a lower classification than endangered, or higher, depending on how you look at it, but it requires less protection under federal and state threatened, and that's its status. It may be downlisted from that, because it is in good status in Oregon as well as the continent of the United States, the lower 48.
If you have 30-some species listed under the ESA, how many of those do you have movement on from the federal or state level in say, a 12-month period of lowering the status or raising the status or delisting or et cetera? You have any idea
It might be a better question to ask Martin Nugent, but I would, as I recall, we're talking about no more than one species a year that seems to be moving up and down on the list, or maybe even less than that.
Mr. Chair, in conclusion, I'd like to say that we were involved in the major modification of the state act that happened about 8 years ago. And we understand there are concerns within our community as well as within this body about the issue of delisting and the process of making that the standards more clear. And if there is a work group that, as Mr. Elliker suggested, we'd be delighted to be part of that and provide our expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haney. I'm assuming as we call you up here that you want to speak on both bills, so if you do not, please indicate so. Jared Bradford.
Mr. Chair, while the next witness is coming forward, could I just comment on these that I have?
Yes, let's go ahead and do that. That's a good idea.
I've received two communications, one from Hell's Canyon Preservation Council in LeGrand, and one from Defenders of Wildlife in Ashland, opposing both of these bills. I don't want to read them into the record, but I would request that they go into the record and that copies be made available to the members of the committee.
Very good. And we'll see that our administrator does that. Apparently, Mr. Broadfoot is not here, so we'll go to George Hutchman. Well, I guess George is not here either. So.
Of course, Chair. Sorry, I'm getting some of my email address so I can comment.
Oh, well, we just caught you at the very bad time to be doing it, George. And you're going to have to explain to us what CROW is.
Ah, yes, what CROW is.
Good morning.
Good morning. CROW is the Coalition for the Recovery of Oregon Wolves. I am not a paid staff member. I am not here as a spokesperson for CROW. I am a private, unpaid to be here citizen. I've lived in Southern Oregon for 15 years. I recently moved to Portland. The groups that I personally do represent are the Provolt Grange, the Deer Creek Valley Natural Resource Conservation Association, and seven other environmental groups, many of which you have heard of, including the Sierra Club, Headwaters, and the Rogue Klamath, the Rogue Klamath Wildlife Center and the Siskiyou Project, among them. These groups and I see these two bills essentially as an attack on Oregon's Endangered Species Act. We're very concerned that this is going to be the beginning of a political bloodletting process that needn't be undertaken. I've heard a couple of really good proposals here this morning by other speakers. I'm particularly intrigued and supportive of ODFW's proposal for a working group. And I think that working group would give you the opportunity to help create a consensus on how to fix problems with the state's ESA, to get all the stakeholders at the same table, Mr. Chair, to work out a proposal for your consideration. Seems like a really good idea. So that, in essence, is really all I have to say, is don't jump into this with one or two or three species delistings on your mind. Don't start another bear, cougar, whipsaw, expensive, divisive political struggle. Let's let ODF&W come up with some proposals, and let's listen to them carefully, and you help ODF&W get all the stakeholders at the table: environmental groups, land use groups, farmers, ranchers, hunters, everybody, a good cross-section of the citizens of Oregon. I agree wholeheartedly with the wildlife folks that said listing should be done on a scientific basis. Delisting also should be done on a scientific basis. Implementation, that is your guys' job. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Hutchison? Thank you very much for your testimony. Jennifer Flint.
Sorry. I'm still nervous.
I'll spill it here and there, you know.
Apparently Jennifer's not here.
No, Jennifer's coming up.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were getting the email from George. Sorry, George. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to share comments on both bills, 2458 and HB 2468. For the record, I am Jennifer Flint. I'm here on behalf of the Audubon Society of Portland. In fact, the testimony that I'm going to read was written by an Audubon Society of Portland member. And I'm not an expert in this area, but will do my best to convey the accurate comments of the Audubon Society of Portland and be happy to relay questions to them. So with your permission, I would like to comment on both bills at the same time. That's okay. Audubon Society of Portland opposes these bills because they do not allow for a careful, unbiased scientific process regarding delisting, and they will essentially eliminate the effectiveness of the Oregon Endangered Species Act. I guess Chair Garrard isn't here to sneeze at that one this time. More specifically, we oppose these bills because they would repeal the Oregon Endangered Species Act, cause loss of Oregon's treasured animals and biodiversity, and cede Oregon state power to the federal government. By empowering any single person to prohibit Oregon protection of any species with the mere filing of a petition for listing pursuant to the Federal Endangered Species Act. As written, these bills would empower anyone and everyone to delist a species off of the Oregon Endangered Species Act simply by petitioning the federal government to list the species under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Audubon Society of Portland opposes these bills because delisting with the federal government list may endanger Oregon's biodiversity. Under HB 2468, if the species warrants protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act, it is in Oregon's best interest to continue to protect that species as well under the Oregon Endangered Species Act. If the species is on the brink of extinction, Oregon shouldn't risk leaving it solely up to the federal government to protect that species. As you know, the federal government protects certain species based upon its own scientific information and the politics of the day. If Oregon stops protecting species that are currently on the list of animals protected by the federal government, then when the feds delist the animals, the protection is gone, causing Oregon potentially a great loss. It has been suggested that one purpose of HB 2468 is to delist the gray wolf, although there are significant legal questions whether it would have that effect. However, we do know that the gray wolf is politically unpopular with the Bush administration, and the administration is moving to reduce its legal protection of the gray wolf. Under HB 2468, opponents of the gray wolf could simply file a petition to the federal government to delist it, thereby automatically delisting the gray wolf under the Oregon Endangered Species Act. Thus, our position that the bills do not allow for a careful, unbiased scientific process regarding delisting and will essentially eliminate the effectiveness of the Oregon Endangered Species Act. With that, thank you for the opportunity to be here again. And if you have any questions, I will be happy to relay them to the Audubon Society of Portland.
Thank you, Jennifer. Questions for Jennifer?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Vice Chair.
Whatever.
It sounded like from your testimony that you're interpreting this bill as saying that somebody could force the state to remove a species simply by appealing to the federal government to delist, and my reading of it is that the federal government would actually have to act on that and decide to delist before this would kick in. Do you have a different...
Representative Rosenbaum, I am not sure what their how they would clarify that. I understand the confusion, and I'll check with them on that and get back to the committee.
Thanks.
I think what was being implied is that if it gets placed on the federal list, then it's off of Oregon's list, and therefore we've lost control as Oregon. But the implication is that the federal listing would be some kind of a disaster when all it's really doing is transferring the responsibility from the state to the Federal Endangered Species Act.
Representative Richardson, I agree that that was the point they were trying to make with that.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Al, you're up next. Al Alkin.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. We're an association of 9,000 members that spend over $100,000 a year in wildlife and habitat projects. And we are here to talk about in support of 2458 and would like to see or like to be part of the work group that we've talked about previously. But our concern about the bill is something that Mr. Elliker from ODFNW talked about in his testimony, and that's the, on the bottom of the first sheet of his handout on 2458, which has to do with the delisting, and this bill does not speak to that. In his attachment on number four, he talks about clarifying the delisting or downlisting process, and through the myriad of wolf workshops that we've attended, we have found that the relationship between the federal ESA and the state ESA, and if you delist one and one or one and the other, what the relationship is, really does need to be clarified. And Representative Richardson's comment earlier about the process, overly restrictive, I think a work group could get in and look at that and help clarify some of the points that ODFNW has listed. So that's what we have to say on the bill. I'm not the brightest bulb on the ESA marquee, but I did I could understand both ODFW's frustration and in dealing with the wolf and the comments that were made by the public in relation to the federal ESA, and I think a work group could help them get through some of those issues. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Al. Any questions for Mr. Aikens? Thank you, Al. Jim Wells.
Chair Gerard, committee members, the Oregon State and Grange. I'm Jim Welsh, representing Oregon State and Grange, and we'd just like to go on very quickly on record in support of these two bills. We believe for social, political, and economic reasons they can make very good sense. We would like to see the... they make good sense whether the state is in a good economic situation or not. Neither one of these bills seem to make sense. So. And we'd like to see the possibility of reducing duplication, reducing the extra actions and costs around having a duplicative Oregon revised statute on endangered species. And it would reduce very possibly a lot of the conflict and argument that we see. And Mr. Chair, if you have a work group, we would like to participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions of Mr. Welch?
I do, sir.
Representative Greenland.
Good morning. As a member of the Skyline Grange, you could help me understand your position. Whether the issue that you're raising is purely technical. Is the Grange worried simply about the questions of complexity in the law, complexity in the process, or does the Grange, as the Audubon Society, of which I'm also a member, just said that the purpose of this might be essentially to weaken the Endangered Species Act application in Oregon? I mean, is it a technical matter, or would you just like to get rid of some of the protections for what are now considered endangered species?
Chair Gerard and Representative Greenlick, I think, not having a time to sit down with a number of the board and discuss this at length, and we will come up with a written comments to this if it goes further, certainly, and if there's a work group. But we believe there are certain and very definite technical reasons that make sense. And the duplication that we have seen and live with over a period of time has cost the agency time and money, and thus the taxpayers. We think the Federal Endangered Species Act that we all have to live with no matter what can take care of the situation in most cases in the state. And we believe that technical reasons will override the political reasons in this.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions of Mr. Welch? Thank you, Jim. The chair, that ends our testimony on 2458 and 2468. The chair will consider a work group, and we will announce that. Actually, before I adjourn on this hearing, Mr. Nugent, would you come back up just for a moment? I have one question for you. When we talk about the duplication that exists between the federal and the state, could you give me a ballpark figure as to a cost to the state of Oregon because of that duplication?
Mr. Chair, that's something that I'll have to go back and work out for you. I would point out, though, the reverse of that in many ways, that we, through our Threatened and Endangered Species Program, and the current state act is part of that, we have a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under Section 6 of the Endangered Species Act that actually brings in money to the department and to the state for recovery and management purposes. And that money comes on with some leverage. We have a 25% of state dollars. We can bring in 75% federal dollars to help us with recovery efforts. So looking at it from that positive point of view, we have over the years since 1986 had quite a lot of financial support from the Fish and Wildlife Service to do that. We also act very much in partnership with the service to do many of the recovery efforts for species, and so that very much minimizes, as the spirit of the Act is intended to minimize duplication, working with the service in habitat conservation planning for species in the state forests. Currently there's one working on the beaches too for snowy plovers and other species, so there's an opportunity for cooperative work there. The issue of the Washington ground squirrel has been brought up as well, and there's a candidate conservation agreement there that brings a cooperation between Fish and Wildlife Service and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and other partners too. So that's like just answering questions on the positive side in terms of the cost of duplication and the implications of your question. Perhaps if I could get back to you with that.
I would appreciate that.
Certainly.
I'm simply concerned that these two bills might require a referral if there is an impact to the state in that regard.
Yes, sir. One other thing I might just add, if I may, that in terms of working together, that one of the primary ways of species recovery at the federal level is the federal recovery plans. The department's very much involved with being members of the recovery team and working through those recovery plans to avoid that duplication of work. The plan brings about the scientific, the management, the financial element of recovery, and usually pulls apart what the costs will be, how they'll be derived, and very much focuses on that partnership and cooperation. So our involvement with the Fish and Wildlife Service through that particular mechanism again minimizes that duplication and works to great efficiency, and we've done that with some of the species that have been talked about today, the bald eagle, snowy plover, peregrine falcon. That's been very much a partnership and very, very minimal duplicative action, or certainly not duplicative fund or use of public money for that. So that's been a very positive thing and a collaborative effort between the service, ourselves, and many other partners as well.
And just for my edification, do you have a ballpark figure on one species that you receive federal funds in regard to? What kind of money are we talking about that 75% would represent?
Mr. Chairman, we've in recent years the money that's come to the state has been for Washington ground squirrel management, and we've had $50,000 or $60,000 per year through an individual COP agreement. Going back to a species that we are reaching recovery on, as mentioned, the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon, we had $50,000 or $60,000 per year from the Fish and Wildlife Service for peregrine falcon recovery, which involved a reintroduction program and monitoring that followed it, and we've had money through the years to carry that out. We've also used our own resources, and from my particular program, the funding comes principally through donations and tax checkoff, and we've used those relatively few dollars that we have through that program to match the federal dollars. And that's made a significant contribution to the recovery of those species. And most important, of course, as well, is to be able to track that success. So some of that, the funding has gone into monitoring and surveying to ensure that the direction of recovery is going the right way and we're doing the right thing. So that's been quite a long process over 10 or 15 years for the peregrine falcon and bald eagle. But the effort has certainly paid off.
I recall as a county commissioner doing bird overlays on the peregrine falcon down in my neck of the woods. So I know it is somewhat of an involved process, but I appreciate you giving us just ballpark numbers in that regard. Are there any other questions? Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, I'm just somewhat concerned that we don't have a statement from the federal regulatory agency that might be in this. I wonder if we could get some statement or get them here as a witness. And I say that for this reason. This is somewhat of a replay of what occurred in the Agriculture and Forestry Committee last year, and I sat on that committee. A little variation of the theme, and that was to make the gray wolf and the trumpeter swan a predator under, classify them as predators under an Oregon Act, which can be done. If they achieve that status, then they could be eradicated any time by members of the public. And that gave a false impression, I think, to the agricultural community that they could do that, even if they, without knowing that by taking a gray wolf or a trumpeter swan with no liability under state law, they were still committing a federal crime. So I think we should complete the loop here to make sure, in our minds, that there's no federal preemption of some of the issues we're dealing with. I don't know that there is or there isn't, but I think we should clarify the records how far, you know, we can go in these two bills. I'm not expressing an opinion either way, but I do feel that unless we hear the federal side of this, we may be into an area that's federally preempted. We won't know it.
Thank you. Hey, would you see if you can contact someone, a federal representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I know Representative Zahner's ears popped up with the trumpeter swan brought up. Thank you, Mr. Nugent-Bergh. Yes.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on 2468 and 2458 and open a public hearing on 2533, which parallels along the lines of House Bill 2466, which we heard earlier this week. So our intention here is to move 2466 into 2533.
You're right.
And
when it gets scared,
Ms. Butterfield, could you come up, please, for our...
I'm not quite sure what our intention.
And I think that probably after your testimony, we're going to have to adjourn and reconvene next week and pick this same subject up. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. On Tuesday, you heard about the hazardous substance possession fee and some of the inequities in that fee. Today's bill focuses on one of the programs in that fee, the toxic use reduction program. And I would submit to you that if you could fix the funding issues concerned with that particular program, a lot of the concerns might go away. I'm here, I forgot to tell you, I'm here representing the Northwest Propane Gas Association. And as you heard last week, propane is not required to file a toxic use and hazardous waste reduction plan, yet we pay for it. We believe that a more fair method should be found to support the program, and this bill is one approach, but perhaps there are others. Decoupling this particular program from the hazardous substance possession fee is one way to look at solving the problem. I want to make clear that program requirements were changed several years ago so that small quantity generators no longer have to do annual plan updates, but the funding structure wasn't changed. And not only have the small generators been exempted out from an annual plan, I have been hearing from a number of sources that large generators don't really find it that useful. And I've given you some testimony, I mean some documentation of that from the DEQ Hazardous Waste Work Group minutes, and they're in your packet. I also have a question about some information I received from state agencies that notes that 710 facilities are subject to the TUR planning, but only 447 pay a hazardous substance possession fee. So I'm questioning what's happening with the other 233 companies who do file a plan but don't pay a fee when my people don't pay a fee. And
by
so
the way, Elena, we did not receive your packet.
Oh, you know what? I am really sorry. My apologies.
I'm sorry to have interrupted you.
You should have. That's good. I deserve to be interrupted. The bottom line in all of this is that this particular program is causing fee payers a lot of grief because we look at it and we see the substance of the program maybe needs to be reviewed and that maybe it needs to be funded in a different manner. We believe that 2533 is a fair approach because it's basically a user pay sort of approach, and we'd like to see you look at this issue carefully. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Butterfield? Thank you. We have five more people to testify, and we have some committee members that have to get going at this point. So I apologize for those of you that wanted to testify this morning, but we will reschedule as quickly as we can. I'd like to let the committee know that we have extended an invitation to Mr. Paul Kucherko, who is the departing director of LCDC, to appear before this committee, and we have also requested the entire LCDC commission to appear before this committee, and we have also invited our Senate colleagues to join us in hearing both of all the testimony from those two entities. With that, I will adjourn at 10:25 a.m.
So Frankie is not the commissioner, huh?